inns, there's a saloon, a hotel, and the chance of a gunfight. At its height in 1910, Shanico had about 600 residents and a reputation as a rowdy place. A 1908 article in the Oregonian described the small town as, quote, an oasis in a saloonless region. Shanico takes pride in its status as a ghost town. Although it is a functioning municipality with about 24 full-time residents, the decor of the saloon, vintage newspaper, and tree stumps as stools transports visitors back in time to around 1901. The town mainly failed due to the opening of a rival railroad and a fire that destroyed much of the town in 1911. The saloon building was originally a garage for a wool warehouse before being moved from its original location and then converted into an old-time saloon in the 1980s. In the past, the Shanico Historic Preservation Guild contracted with the High Desert Rangers Gunfighters Club and would open the saloon during the annual celebration, Shanico Days. This summer, the president of the Gunfighters Club is aiming to opening every weekend, offering a selection of root beers, sodas, and adult beverages with wings and nachos ready to serve. There's a fire pit out back, where on the last Saturday of the month, locals and visitors gather for bluegrass jam sessions. Benjamin Harleman, the president of the Gunfighters Club, said, quote, "Everybody who comes in loves it. We have people here who fall in love with it so much they'll hang out until they can't stay awake any longer sitting by the fire," end quote. The Gunfighters Club stage mock gunfights during Shanico Days, held the first weekend in August, but if there's a crowd, they will put on a show, even keeping fake warrants behind the bar to take people to the original Shanico Jail. For KBOO Evening News, I'm David Chittenden.
So glad to have you with us as you're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, July 24th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dave Chittenden, James Kemp, Anna Wilcox, Corbin Vale, and Isabel Charlet. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The interim evening news director is Hannah Francis. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I am Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. Nuclear weapons experts issue a proclamation on nuclear war. The world's first climate visa. And the European Union is accused of complicity in Israel's assault in Gaza. First, the nuclear weapons experts proclamation. On July 16, about 80 years since the Trinity nuclear test, 20 Nobel laureates and about 60 leading nuclear experts issued a declaration on the prevention of nuclear war. The experts warn that the nuclear danger remains very high, and they urge several steps, besides the elimination of all nuclear weapons, to mitigate the danger. Here are just a few of them. We call on all states to reiterate their commitment to a moratorium on nuclear explosive testing and do what is necessary to secure the prompt entry into force of the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. Next, we call on Russia and the U.S. to immediately enter into negotiations on a successor to the 2010 New Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, remain committed to the treaty's central limits in the meantime, and expand dialogue. We call on China to immediately enter into substantive and sustained discussions on their rapidly expanding nuclear arsenal. Next, we call on all states to engage in increased cooperative dialogue on the scientific, legal, and military implications of artificial intelligence and other advanced technologies. We call on all nuclear-armed states to ensure meaningful and enhanced human control and oversight over nuclear command and control. And last, with regard to the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, we call on every nation to publicly recommit to all non-proliferation and disarmament objectives and obligations in the treaty, and reject and condemn proliferation by any state, including allies. Tuvalu, a country consisting of 9 atolls and islands, about halfway between Hawaii and Australia, is only 2 meters above sea level. It faces risks of permanent inundation from rising ocean levels. Over half of Funafuti, the capital, could be regularly flooded by tidal surges by 2050, according to the UN. Tuvalu is now hoping to acquire the world's first climate migration visa that will allow 280 citizens to move every year to Australia, where they will have the right to live, study, and work without restriction. The most recent data shows that Tuvalu has a population of just over 11,000, and already over half the population has submitted applications to move. The permanent residency pathway is a key feature of the Falapili Union, a treaty entered into by Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and his Tuvaluan counterpart Filito Teo in August 2024. Under the pact, Australia would support Tuvalu in adapting to climate change and help during natural disasters. But the climate visa isn't just about Australian generosity, it's also about China. Australia would have veto power over any security arrangements the island nation seeks to establish with other countries. The reference is to a Chinese base in a part of the Pacific that Beijing has been actively engaged in diplomatically and economically. Tuvalu currently recognizes Taiwan as China, but as happened in the Solomon Islands, a change of government could lead to a change in China policy and security ties that would shift from Australia to China. As a side note, just as Tuvalu might become the first country to be lost to the climate crisis, Kabul, Afghanistan, might be the first capital city to run out of water. That's according to the Mercy Corps' reporting. Population growth, the climate crisis, and over-extraction of water are said to be responsible. Kabul citizens must pay a high price for water and use it sparingly. The Mercy Corps' program director in Afghanistan says, quote, "It's a health crisis, an economic crisis, and a humanitarian emergency all in one." Next, the European Union is accused of complicity in Israel's assault in Gaza. The UN Special Rapporteur on Occupied Palestine accused the EU of, quote, "consciously supporting Israel's genocide of the Palestinians," unquote, by refusing to suspend the EU-Israel Association Agreement. That agreement, which covers political and economic relations, includes a binding clause requiring respect for human rights and democratic principles. EU foreign ministers failed to reach consensus on suspending the agreement and imposing sanctions on Israel, starting with an arms embargo. This news comes as killings of desperately hungry people in Gaza are rising fast. Over the weekend, 79 Gazans were killed by the Israeli Defense Forces when a UN Food for Peace truck was mobbed in northern Gaza. As usual in such incidents, the IDF did not acknowledge the figure and merely said troops fired warning shots. The Israeli authorities are starving civilians in Gaza, the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees said in a post on X. Among them are 1 million children. In other news, the Pentagon spells out its insecurity. The Defense Department has chosen not to attend an annual meeting of the Aspen Security Forum, which typically attracts policy wonks, journalists, and military figures for open-ended discussions. The Pentagon's reason for not attending reveals both extraordinary insecurity and deep-seated hostility. A Pentagon press secretary said, quote, "The Department of Defense has no interest in legitimizing an organization that has invited former officials who have been the architects of chaos abroad and failure at home. They are antithetical to the America First values of this administration. senior representatives of the Department of Defense will no longer be participating in an event that promotes, now get this, the evil of globalism, disdain for our great country, and hatred for the President of the United States, unquote. In short, the Pentagon will only be represented at events hosted by loyal functionaries who love Donald Trump. As the New York Times points out in reporting this news, use of the word evil has become a fixture in the administration's vocabulary. Critics of the Trump regime are automatically evil. That's what dictators say. China extends its forced labor policy in Xinjiang. A joint investigation by the New York Times, the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, and Der Spiegel in Germany has revealed that Uyghurs are being sent out of their homeland, Xinjiang, in China's far west, on government work programs more widely than previously documented. This makes identifying companies that are using Uyghur labor much harder. The investigation found that 70 factories located all across China are employing forced labor from Xinjiang. Most of the factories are distant from Xinjiang, such as several in Guangdong province in the southeast coast. As usual, Chinese officials deny that forced labor exists and insist that Uyghurs are being treated with an eye to their security and well-being. Being sent far off for labor is a way to defeat idleness, officials say. The Chinese embassy in Washington said the government's policies make the region safer. Xinjiang-related issues are not human rights issues at all, but in essence about countering violent terrorism and separatism, a statement said. U.S.-China trade tensions are easing. In stark contrast with tit-for-tat tariff increases a month ago, U.S.-China trade is moving in a more positive direction. China has eased access to rare earth minerals, and the U.S. has approved sales of advanced, but not the most advanced, AI chips from NVIDIA to China. U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent acknowledged the minerals for chips exchange, saying, quote, it's all part of a mosaic. The deal still leaves plenty of trade issues to negotiate, starting with the 30% tariff on Chinese imports. As usual, Trump's personal interest is involved. He evidently is desperate to visit China, having failed to get an invitation from Xi Jinping at the height of the trade war. More on the trade war, a few trade deals, but more tariff hikes to come. Apart from the ongoing exchanges with China, all that President Trump can claim in his tariff war so far is framework agreements with Britain, Vietnam, and Indonesia, and tariff rate agreements with the Philippines and Japan. Even the agreement with Vietnam is shaky, as the Vietnamese are saying that what is on paper is not what they bargained for. The Philippines president was just in Washington seeking a trade deal, but his effort to get a low tariff rate failed. The Philippines will face a 19% U.S. tariff rate, just a 1% reduction from Trump's initial rate, while U.S. exports to the Philippines will be tariff-free. As for Japan, Trump agreed to reduce the tariff rate from 25% to 15% and says Japan is committed to $550 billion in investments in the United States. But a photo of Trump's announcement card taken from behind him shows different figures for both the tariff rate and the investment pledge. As for the Japanese, they're not at all happy. They believe they've been bullied. Trump's tariffs are now expected to hit an average effective rate of 20.6%, the highest since 1910. The inflationary impact is already happening, contrary to the administration's denials and obfuscations. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell has become Trump's latest favorite target for refusing to drop interest rates. Powell has made clear that he views the tariffs as likely to raise consumer prices, hence be inflationary, and won't lower interest rates merely to please Trump. Most observers believe that should Trump fire Powell, a step that is probably illegal, the U.S. economy will be in much worse shape than it already is. U.S.-Iran nuclear talks have vanished. No talks are taking place, so far as anyone outside the administration can tell. It evidently has no plans to resume talks. Trump seems to have decided that the bombing of Iran was successful and that the Iranians will come running at some point to make a deal whose terms he will dictate. Meantime, Iran will suffer from tightening sanctions from the Europeans as well as from the U.S. Iran's chief points of contention are that negotiations must allow for a certain level of uranium enrichment and provide security guarantees against a resumption of attacks from Israel. The Trump administration seems highly unlikely to satisfy either of those requirements. Britain lowers the voting age to 16. Britain will lower the voting age from 18 to 16 by the next national election as part of measures to increase democratic participation. The changes must be approved by Parliament. The next national election must be held by 2029. The centre-left Labour Party pledged before it was elected in July 2024 to lower the voting age for elections to Britain's Parliament. Scotland and Wales already let 16 and 17-year-olds vote in local and regional elections. Germany and Belgium allow voting at 16 in European Parliament elections. Japan's ruling party suffers a defeat in the upper house. Prime Minister Ishiba Shigeru's Liberal Democratic Party lost its majority in the Japanese parliament's upper house in elections July 20th. It was the party's second major defeat, having lost control of the lower house last October. Ishiba vows to carry on, but the election loss could trigger his resignation or political deadlock in parliament, since any legislation will require that the Liberal Democratic Party and its partner Kometo find a third party to form a majority. The main winners in the election are the populist opposition parties, especially the Democratic Party for the People and Sanseito. The right-wing Sanseito's candidates campaigned on the slogan "Japanese First," signaling an anti-immigrant posture that worries foreign residents in Japan. Finally, two updates. First, from Brazil. The U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has reportedly stripped 8 of Brazil's 11 Supreme Court judges of their U.S. visas as the White House escalates its campaign to help the country's former president, Jair Bolsonaro, avoid justice over his alleged attempt to seize power with a military coup. Bolsonaro faces major jail time if, as expected, he is convicted. Brazil's president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, has refused to cave in to Trump's pressure tactics, which include a 50% tariff rate on Brazilian exports to the U.S. He said, quote, "Interference in another country's justice system is unacceptable and offends the basic principles of national sovereignty and respect between nations." A prominent Brazilian academic said Trump's interference is, quote, "a political gift for Lula, who now gets to credibly present himself as a symbol of national resistance while leaving his opponents scrambling to choose between loyalty to Bolsonaro and the economic interests of their own base," unquote. Lula had the final word, saying, quote, "If Trump was a Brazilian, and if he did what happened at Capitol Hill," referring to the attempted coup on January 6, "he'd also be on trial in Brazil." And finally, Trump's executive order to impose sanctions on judges of the International Criminal Court has been blocked by a federal judge. The ruling follows an April lawsuit by two human rights advocates challenging Trump's February 6 order authorizing sanctions on people who work on the International Criminal Court's investigations of U.S. citizens or U.S. allies, such as Israel. The judge in the case said Trump's order violates free speech. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening.
And you say there are a number of sick people as well as pets. Mm. Would that be dogs and cats or mostly dogs? What's going on there?
You know, people are having all different issues with different kinds of animals. There was recently a post on Facebook about dogs that have died since the derailment. I didn't count, but I think there was like 63 comments. You know, some of them were saying they were sorry, but most of them were young dogs that were dying unexpectedly. We have dogs that have like, they're almost like fatty tumors on them. We have, you know, cats that are sick. We also have a woman who reported she's raised goats for like 20 years. And this, you know, the year after the derailment, all of her goats miscarried and she found the fetuses in her field. Another gentleman had domesticated foxes. His foxes were all born with cleft palates, liver issues after they were born. And we even just had a lawsuit filed. One kennel had a dog born with two heads. The reason why they research dogs when it comes to chemicals is because they're a precursor to human health. We did have one study that was done from the University of Massachusetts, but it was only phase one. It was looking at dogs from Pittsburgh to East Palestine and measuring, I think it was PAHs or PAFs, I'm sorry, not a science person.
PFAS.
In the Yeah, in the PFAS, I think. I don't know. But anyways, the closer it got to East Palestine, the more the dogs had in them. The second phase was a blood draw that we hosted last June to take the blood from the dogs and to see if we could prove the chemicals were from the derailment. And the results from that should be released soon.
And isn't the National Institutes of Health supposed to be doing their own study on this?
J.D. Vance just announced $10 million. It's going to be 1 to 3 studies. And, you know, even though we're grateful, it's nowhere near the amount of money that we need. I've been working with Dr. Gollum from the University of California, San Diego. She's doing a research study on East Palestine. And it's interesting because she started with studying our Gulf War veterans. She worked at a VA when they were coming home from the war, the veterans, the VA was saying, just give them psych meds. You know, and she did this research and she was like one of the leading reasons why Gulf War illness is recognized and we have the PACT Act. So now she's working in East Palestine and she's comparing our symptom profiles to that of the veterans. She did a case study. It's called Echoes of Gulf War Illness. But now that I'm working with her, I see things that happen where I realize the grant money is nowhere near enough. One example is people's teeth are starting to fall out. So, you know, it might be, you know, if she comes up with the idea, well, it might just be like, I don't know, pH balance in your mouth. Well, that's an added cost to the study. And they're so grossly underfunded. I mean, 1 to 3 studies for a 20-mile radius, I feel strongly that they have the perfect guinea pigs. You know, do the extensive testing, put the money into it now, because then when things happen like this in Moss Landing, California, and Conyers, Georgia, you know, we already have some answers. Don't make them the guinea pigs. Use us. We need more funding. We're grateful, but we need more.
And a lawsuit has been filed, right, on behalf of the victims of the train derailment. Could you talk about that?
So the judge here in our Northern District of Ohio court decided that it was going to be a class action. These attorneys came in, these bigwig attorneys from out of town. They came up with a settlement with Norfolk Southern before the NTSB hearing findings were even out. I called one of the lead attorneys and I said, this don't make sense. Like, why are you trying to settle when the research isn't in, NTSB isn't in, our creeks are still highly contaminated? And he said, I'm going to stop you right there. You are not going to talk to me about conspiracy theories with Norfolk Southern's attorneys. They have your best interest at heart. And I said, you stop right there. Obviously, you don't know who you're talking to. And second of all, I'd be an idiot to believe that. Who would hire an attorney that had the other party's best interest in hand? And I knew then we were screwed. So how they were advertising it at first is people would get an average. They did it in different mile radiuses, like 1 to 2 miles and then 2 to 5. And they had the scale. And they said that residents in the 1 to 2 mile zone would get $70,000 per household and $10,000 to sign away all your medical rights. So per household, I live in that 1 to 2 mile zone. There's 4 people in my household, $17,500 each. But wait, we would get zero because we were relocated. All the money that they spent keeping me in a hotel for almost a year would be deducted from that $70,000. When it comes to the what people are calling personal injury, the signing off on all your medical rights for $10,000, there was a clause in there in the settlement agreement that said there's one pot of money, $120 million for a 10-mile radius of what people are calling personal injury. So they were saying that people in the 1 to 2 mile zone would get about $10,000, but the clause in there said that there had to be a certain number of people, and it was confidential number of people that had to sign up or Norfolk was pulling the settlement. So like, for example, if one person signed up, they're not going to give them the full $120 million. So not enough people signed up. So the attorneys, our attorneys, the attorneys for the class action, the residents' lead counsel had a Zoom, they called it a town hall meeting, where they had a gentleman by the name of Chip Carson get on there and tell residents 0 cases of cancer and 0 long-term health impacts from the derailment. And you could look Mr. Carson up on LinkedIn. He worked for Dow Chemicals. He worked for Chevron. He worked for Exxon and a couple of other places that were corporate polluters.
So why would a plaintiff's attorneys hire someone like that?
Well, they did. They made sure it was very weird. They said, well, he's not really working for us, and he's not our...
He's supposed to be neutral.
Expert. Yeah. Norfolk Southern hired him, in my opinion. So then they also, the lead counsel hired their own testing expert, who was like a leading dioxin expert in the United States. They suppressed all of his results and won't even release them after the settlement's over. And again, I will send you this folder. You can see a subfolder called Class Action. I have the video link in there so you can watch what Dr. Carson said. I have his work history from LinkedIn. I also have an affidavit that was signed by this testing expert that they hired. He has a confidentiality agreement, but what he could say is that his testing results were in line with Scott Smith, who's an independent tester who's found dioxin all through our community. But here's the kicker. Two things real quick. I get into this. First of all, the day of the settlement hearing, the judge was completely like dismissing the attorney that was arguing, like, we hired our own attorney that said, wait a minute, you guys are lying to us. Dismissed him, didn't even take a minute to decide and said, okay, we're going to finalize the settlement. You know, she made a hearing or a judgment to accept it. So as I stood up and I was walking out the door, I said, this is a sham. Our own attorneys lied to us. And I go outside and a news reporter came up and said, did you hear what she said to you? And when you walked out, and I said, no. She apparently told her federal marshals to put me on the pavement and then stood up and took her fist and slammed them down and leaned over and said, does anybody else in this courtroom want to challenge me? I'm not making this up. This is like real life. Because if I was sitting in your seat before the derailment, I would think, man, this chick is out there. Conspiracy theorist. So at this point right now, the people that did join the class action are waiting on their money. They were told by the attorneys they would get this personal injury money by Christmas, way past Christmas. It was also in the agreement that the attorneys got their $180 million right off the top. Let's put that in perspective, $120 million for personal injury for a 10-mile radius, and they got $180 million. So they already have their money, and the residents, most of them have not seen the money. They hired a third-party administrator to hand the money out. Because you didn't know how much you were going to get when you signed up. That $70,000 wasn't guaranteed. They based it on factors, and you didn't know how much personal injury you were going to get until you signed up. For example, if you were over the age of 65, you automatically got your money cut because your life isn't as valuable as a younger person. So people still don't have their money. Now, people like me that opted out, I hired Keenan Law Firm, and I hired them because they are trial attorneys. Our justice system was set up to go in front of a jury of your peers. Now there's so many settlements and plea agreements that the whole justice system is controlled by, you know, the attorneys and the judges. So it's the betrayal from our government is outlandish. We just revealed documents where the CDC told our local doctors not to test or treat us for chemical exposure, literally going into the doctors and they denied us testing.
Are you getting any support from local or state officials?
No, not even a bottle of water.
You'd think that at least the reputation of Norfolk would have suffered. Is that true at all in the court of public opinion? No.
There were signs in our town thanking Norfolk Southern. What they did is they openly paid off our village government, a $25 million park. That was what was all over the news, and now they're pulling out of some of this. They promised a $25 million park, community of 4,700. It's going to have an aquatic center, amphitheater. That's why I lived in East Palestine and moved from Cleveland. I didn't want all that. And what we really needed was a cancer center. They gave like $750,000 to our school district to recruit students, another million. They gave all of our teachers $500 gift cards. Bought the kid stuff. They were supposed to put in a state-of-the-art training center. Now they pulled out. News is gone. But basically, I mean, they openly bought out our officials. Our town is so divided right now. There's the people that say nothing's wrong, let's move on. And people that say, hey, wait, I'm sick. You know, people are sick.
So the population is what, around 5,000?
4,700.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, 4,700. But it's basically the haves and the have-nots. Norfolk Southern sat there and watched who ran the town and who had the money. Right away, he was having secret meetings with the business owners. You know, we found out that...
This would make a good movie, I think, yeah.
Oh, and I'm just the tip. I mean, I get going and it's like getting someone to listen. And like I said, before this derailment, I would have thought I was nuts. Like, you know, you hear people say, oh, the government made up these COVID vaccinations to, and I thought, I told my husband, he said, what are we going to do when the evacuation's lifted? I said, we're going to go home. If the EPA says it's fine, it's fine. You know, I have a law degree, a master's degree. Soon as I pulled in my driveway and felt my face burning, coughing, couldn't breathe, and look over and see chemicals literally free flowing down the creek, I don't need to be a scientist. Which is also pictures in that folder of the creeks I just took on the 23rd of June. They're still not clean, which I could go into a whole story of the side banks. Like where I lived, there was an embankment on each side. So it would go from like 6 inches to 6 feet when it rained. But they're only remediating the sediment, not those sidewalls. Hmm. Again, a second grader could tell you when the water rise, the chemicals went into that dirt. So you can literally take a shovel of dirt off the sidewall and throw it in the creeks and just watch chemicals come out of it.
Anything else like this ever happened in the state before?
There are derailments every day. I didn't know that. I sent that you could set up a Google alert and I put in train derailments. You'd be shocked. There has been things, but not of this magnitude. Not that's gotten this attention and not where the residents have said, hell no. You know, they thought we were a bunch of idiots, hillbillies. And I think what they really underestimated was the old school morals that our grandparents instilled in us. You know, when we say, Mama Bear, I'll fight to the death for my child. I will literally fight to the death for my child. And it doesn't matter if it's a robber or if it's Norfolk Southern. Mm-hmm. Once I found out that there was creek water coming into my house, and had I not thrown a fit and blindly went into that house, my daughter would be dead right now. I tried for 42 years to have a child and couldn't.